This is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
National Geographic magazine recently apologized for a history of racism in its coverage of non-Western cultures and people of color around the world.
Journalists and news outlets can feed into a racialized crime panic by tapping into scripts that have existed for a long time.
I think that we live in a scary time. People don't know who they can trust. And when that happens, it's easy to manipulate people.
A number of figures on the left have denounced this show as racist.
The Christian fundamentalist movement is one that believes in we're right, you're wrong, no matter what. And I saw a lot of that at Fox.
Twitter is treated very differently than the New York Times. Why are they not treated like media companies?
Today, we are all members of the media.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright. Ever since Joe Biden managed to take office and the whole violent insurrection thing passed on by, a lot of us have been very happy to take a break from national politics. Right after the election, listeners told us over and over again that you were eager to make space in your minds for something else entirely. And that is true for me as anybody else, I gotta say. I mean, I didn't even watch the president's congressional speech this past week, and I am here to tell you I am the kind of political nerd who happily watches presidential speeches to Congress. But this time I just felt like I would rather go have dinner in a beer garden instead. It just felt like a more immediate need. I mean, the sun is shining, the days are longer, I'm vaccinated, and I don't have to wake up every day to new provocations from the president of the United States. It feels like I can turn away from this stuff for just a minute. Except, let's be very clear. The Trump movement has not shrunk into the night. Here lately, I'm actually quite reminded of its beginning, of the birther madness and the lies about a death panel. Remember that during the debate over the Affordable Care Act? And just of everything that circulated, in particularly in conservative media, throughout the Obama years, and how much it all ultimately mattered. So this week, we're turning our attention to what's been happening in right-wing media over the past couple of months. If you aren't already in the audience for it, you have probably seen some of this in your social media feeds, especially Tucker Carlson's increasingly extreme behavior on Fox News primetime, which, by the way, it bears pointing out, continues to comfortably lead cable news ratings even in the post-Trump world. It is dangerously easy to just mock what's been happening on Fox and in other outlets. But I'm joined tonight by someone who's instead spent years studying it. She even DVRs Tucker Carlson's show so she can pick through it on her own time and tell all of us what's going on. Nicole Himmer is a political historian and researcher at Columbia University and author of Messengers on the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. She also co-hosts the podcast Past Present, in which she and some other historians discuss American politics and culture. Nicole, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Nicole, how did you get interested in this in the first place? How did you get invested in the world of right-wing and conservative media and sort of drawn to listening and watching and reading the conversation there?
So this is one of those questions where I can remember the exact moment. I was home from graduate school in the summer of 2004, and I was in the car with my dad, and we were talking, and he was like, you know, my goal for you this summer is to get you to vote for George W. Bush in the presidential election. And he reached over, and he turned on the radio to Rush Limbaugh. And we listened to a lot of conservative talk radio that summer, and while it didn't change my vote in 2004, it got me so interested in the way my dad saw a connection between what we listen to, what media we consume, and how we vote, how we think about our politics. So I was hooked from that moment on, and when I discovered there was a history to all of this, it became kind of my life's work.
All right. What was that connection for your dad, at least, in particular? Why do you think that was so important to him? Not that he would tell you, hey, I've got some ideas for you, but like, here, I want you to listen to this thing.
I think because he found it so entertaining and compelling, and I'm going to say smart. My dad would argue back to the radio. So it's not that he swallowed whole cloth everything that he was hearing on Limbaugh and Hannity and these shows, but he liked being able to interact with it and wrestle with the ideas. And he thought that that presentation of conservatism was something that would get me intrigued.
That's really interesting, too, because, as I said, it's easy to sort of mock. And listen, I'm open about my politics. I don't watch these shows. But this idea that there is a combativeness and a debate with what's happening is part of the draw, or was part of the draw for your dad. I think that's not how a lot of people think about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we tend to, especially if we're not conservative, to think about these programs as kind of brainwashing. And I think that that robs the audience of these shows of their agency, right? They're drawn to these programs for reasons, and they pick and choose from what they hear, what they believe, and how it shapes their politics.
Yeah. Well, listeners, we can take calls for Nicole as we talk, we don't want to just talk about people who watch conservative media. If you are somebody who consumes conservative media, who consumes Tucker Carlson or Fox News, or used to listen to Rush Limbaugh, we want to hear why you tune in and what you're getting from it. 646-435-7280. And Nicole, you recently published an essay on CNN with the headline, quote, "History shows we ignore Tucker Carlson at our peril." And we'll get into the details of that history in a moment. But just in the most basic sense, why do you feel like we should be paying attention to what's happening on his show now, as opposed to saying, you know, this stuff is just meant to troll me if you disagree with it, you know, and roll your eyes and move on? Why is it important to pay attention?
Well, it certainly is meant to troll liberals. That is part of his brand. But it's important because, well, first, as you mentioned, you know, Tucker Carlson is the most watched show on cable news, but he is also very much in touch with the turn that the Republican Party took under Donald Trump. And he represents a powerful wing of the Republican Party. And by listening to him, not only do you kind of understand where that wing of the party sits, but the kinds of arguments that are being used and the kind of code words that are being used. I mean, I think that it's, you know, we'll get into the specifics of it, but, you know, when he talks, he introduces a lot of white supremacist themes into his show, but then he frames them in ways that if you're not paying attention, you might not understand exactly the point that he's trying to make or the history that he's drawing on.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about one of those. I mean, in your CNN essay, "History Shows We Ignore Tucker Carlson at Our Peril," you were responding to his idea, his promotion of this idea of, quote, "white replacement," which is a far-right conspiracy theory originally popularized by a French white supremacist. And for the past few years, this idea has kind of migrated into some mainstream conservative media. And just a few weeks ago, people watching Fox in primetime, watching Tucker Carlson's show, may have heard him say this. Take a listen.
"Now, I know that the left and all the little gatekeepers on Twitter become literally hysterical if you use the term replacement, if you suggest that the Democratic Party is trying to replace the current electorate, the voters now casting ballots, with new people, more obedient voters from the third world. But they become hysterical because that's what's happening, actually. Let's just say it, that's true."
So what is the backstory for this idea that you were trying to trace, particularly in right-wing media circles, Nicole? Can you walk us through that here a bit?
Sure. So the Great Replacement Theory, as you mentioned, is this idea that lax immigration laws are meant to replace white Americans with non-white immigrants. And the reason that I think it's important to understand this history is because in the mid-1990s, this was a pretty mainstream argument. One of the best-selling books of 1995 was a book called Alien Nation by Peter Bremelow. And it made this argument that if America was going to continue to be America, it needed to shut down immigration from non-Western European countries. It needed to protect the whiteness of the United States. And over the course of the late 1990s, Bremelow and those ideas start to get pushed to the fringe. In fact, he would go off to found a white nationalist website called VDare and become part of the movement that would become the alt-right. Seeing how those ideas flow back and forth from mainstream conservatism into the fringe and back again, I think it's important to understand that these are ideas that can easily cross over into the mainstream if we're not talking openly about the very racist ideas that underlie them.
Right. And I mean, so speaking of crossing over to the mainstream, I mean, Tucker Carlson has been saying similar things for a while now. I mean, really since he took the helm of Fox primetime, which of course coincided with the beginning of Trump's presidency. Here he is again back in July of 2017.
Western civilization is our birthright. It makes all good things possible. Undefended, it collapses. And so we've got to fight to preserve it.
So it's not new. That was 2017. But is there anything different about what's been happening since Biden's inauguration that you have noted in this conversation, Nicole? Like any shift in the conversation, either on Carlson's show in particular or just in right-wing media more broadly?
Well, it certainly has been ramped up. Although, again, you know, Carlson had as one of his writers somebody who moved in white supremacist circles. So this is, again, as you pointed out, this is not something that's new for him. But I think one of the things that is new is, you know, during the Trump years, all of the focus was on Donald Trump. And the reason people paid attention to Tucker Carlson was because of Donald Trump. Now that Trump is not really in the mix in the same way, Carlson's words, in a way, carry more power, more weight, because he is one of the leading voices of these ideas. Before it was Donald Trump, now it's Tucker Carlson. So he's getting, I think, a little more open about things. It is more visible precisely because he's not competing in a way with the president of the United States.
Right. He's got more airtime.
That's right.
Let's go to Joe in Miami, Florida. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. Thanks for taking the call. You know, I'm at VA. I'm in my 70s and I travel across the country a lot. And I haven't had a television since 72. So as a result, all my input was for years was reading and the radio. And this has spread like a virus over the last 30 years. Your guest spoke to Rush Limbaugh. I listen to 12 hours a day of hate radio on top of my NPR, not because I enjoy it, but because I understand my background's behavioral psychology, and I understand what the propaganda is doing. I live in a community of tradespeople, retired law enforcement people, majority of whom would have been the backbone of the Democratic Party 40 years ago. And these folks vote Republican. They're good people, but they absolutely know nothing about what's happening in a timely fashion. They knew nothing about Sidney Powell refuting her assertion about election fraud. I just see that the history of our country has used propaganda to upend regimes. We did it in Iran. We did it in Indonesia. And I see the same effort at propaganda from a behavioral standpoint that we've seen over the last 5 years. I don't know how we're going to overcome the Sinclair and Murdoch stranglehold on this country. I'd love to hear any suggestions on that while you're at it. And I thank you for taking the call.
Thanks, Joe. I'm going to leave it there. And Nicole, I'm going to get some answers to that right after we take a quick break. I'm talking with Nicole Hemmer, a political historian and researcher at Columbia University and author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media, and the Transformation of American Politics. And our phones are open. If you or someone in your household regularly consumes and engages with particularly hard right media, tell us why. Or conversely, if you refuse to consume it, but you've got questions about what's happening in those outlets, how things are shifting in the Biden era, call us up, 646-435-7280. That's 646-435-7280. We'll talk more after a break. Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright. I'm talking with Nicole Hemmer, a political historian and researcher at Columbia University and author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media, and the Transformation of American Politics. And Nicole, just before the break, a caller was pointing out that, you know, it just feels like part of it is that people don't know what they're hearing. People have lost. I don't want to misrepresent what he had to say, but I heard him talking about sort of the propaganda and the way it shifts people's thinking. And I want to put that to you because, you know, what is the cause and effect here? I mean, as you study it, do you feel like this is true, what a lot of liberal people like to say is that, oh, people watch these shows and it brainwashes them and they lose track of fact. Or is it vice versa, that these shows are serving an audience that already exists?
So it's a great question, and it's a complicated one, right? It's not one or the other. It's both, that people opt in to listening to conservative radio. I don't think that there are a ton of people who don't understand on some level that they're listening to information from a conservative viewpoint, but that it can draw them further and further to the right, depending on what they're listening to. One of the things that the guest talked about was, you know, driving through the countryside and listening to 12 hours of talk radio a day and coming across people who don't know some of the basic facts of things that are going on in the country. And that's one of the big differences between conservative media in the 1950s and the 1960s, when it existed, but you couldn't have wall-to-wall conservative media. There just wasn't enough of it. It's not until the mid-1990s that there's enough conservative media that you can sort of silo yourself within it. And I think that that's a big difference, and it contributes to the sense that it's propaganda, because it allows you to sort of cut yourself off from contrary information, or to dismiss contrary information that gets into your bubble.
And is that surge in the 90s that you're talking about, where suddenly there became enough of it to sort of silo yourself off in it, is that owing to Rush Limbaugh's popularity? What was the change?
Yeah, Rush Limbaugh is a big part of it. So he goes national in 1988. And by the mid-1990s, there are all sorts of people who are emulating him, like Oliver North and G. Gordon Liddy. In 1996, you have the founding of Fox News, which is modeled off of talk radio, just like MSNBC is. So Rush Limbaugh's success pointed out that there was a big audience for conservative media, and that big audience could be incredibly profitable. And once he sort of was the proof of concept for that, lots of imitators came along after.
All right. Let's go to Rue on the Upper East Side. Rue, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Thanks for calling in. Are you a consumer of any of this media that we're talking about, of conservative media?
On occasion. So I am in NYU student, so I go to a very liberal college. So for a time, I lived with a Republican foster family, where their own kids walked around with Breitbart shirts. And so so after coming out of that, going into my own chosen family, I refuse to believe that the conservative half of the country is simply illogical. But from my perspective, their standpoint is completely illogical. So I turn on Fox News, so I know what the conservative narrative is, because I know that more often than not, there is at least a semblance of a narrative. And another reason I turn it on is so I can see hardline conservative arguments, but just not mainstream progressive media, but so I can see what the opposite arguments are and see if I can come up to a different conclusion than what the mainstream progressive stance is.
And does that work for you?
It makes me feel like I've done the work. So it makes me feel happier with the stance I've arrived at, because it feels like, you know what, I've done my homework. I've crunched the numbers. Mm-hmm. I've thought it through.
Okay. Right. And this is a common thing. Thank you, Rue, for calling in. I think this is a meaningful part of the audience as well for some of these outlets, as folks who genuinely are trying to get a balanced point of view. What about that, Nicole? I mean, the idea that, you know, so Rue's sort of watching skeptically, but I mean, if people are seeking a balanced point of view as a consumer of media right now, I mean, do you feel like... Is there, put it this way, is there a distinction between what is happening in a space like Tucker Carlson's show on Fox and what is happening on MSNBC nowadays? Is there a distinction between those kinds of things, or do they represent two sides of a coin?
I think there is a distinction between them, and you could imagine a time in the future where there isn't necessarily, but, you know, the right has had its own media for a long, long time, and it's become part of what it means to be a conservative in the United States to consume conservative media. So you have this kind of built-in audience, this audience that is eager to tune in and to believe and to absorb a lot of the messages that are coming from these media. And these media have real power within the Republican Party in a way that MSNBC just doesn't. And I always use as the example of the difference between the two. You know, when Michael Steele, who was the head of the Republican National Committee, insulted Rush Limbaugh once, within like 48 hours, he's groveling with an apology because, you know, if you insult Rush Limbaugh, you insult the base of the Republican Party. You just can't really imagine something like that happening if, like, Joe Biden says something cross about Rachel Maddow, right? Mm-hmm. She doesn't have the same kind of pull within the Democratic Party. And that's a real difference. There isn't as strong of a connection between the base of the Democratic Party and us, you know, overtly political media. Mm-hmm.
What about distinctions inside right-wing media at this point? I mean, there was certainly a time, as you point out, where there was a sharp difference between a show like Rush Limbaugh's, say, and, you know, a brainy magazine like the National Review, that there was a range of conservative thought. What is the landscape now, you think? Do those distinctions still exist?
They exist up to a point. I mean, there has been a real revolution within conservative media during the Trump years. The collapse of anti-Trump conservative media, you know, National Review prior to Trump's election had come out with a whole issue about why he wasn't fit to be president. And by, you know, a couple years into the Trump administration, it was functionally a pro-Trump outlet, maybe not as much so as other outlets, but there wasn't a lot of space for anti-Trump conservatism. And so there's been a kind of collapse during the Trump years of that more capacious conservative media of an earlier era. It could come back, but it hasn't yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the distinctions is, you know, so we're talking about this, we've talked about these sort of increasingly unapologetic white supremacy on a show like Tucker Carlson's, you know, and again, Fox Primetime remains the far and away ratings leader in cable news. So just take that in. But there's also the, frankly, lying and misinformation that I mentioned at the start of the show. Last week, there was a story circulating that falsely claimed that detained migrant children were handed copies of Vice President Kamala Harris's children's book upon entry into detention centers. That began as a report here at the New York Post. And it was, you know, easily established as false, but it spread so rapidly. And of course, that is by no means the first example. In this time, can you help us understand how this is happening? I mean, is it as cynical as it appears to be as a student of it, or has outright lying always been a staple of the right wing media? You know, is this a cynical tool, or is there something deeper that's at play?
Well, it is a cynical tool in a lot of ways. There are fewer safeguards for stories that fit in with the ideology of the outlets, right? So something that confirms the priors of conservative media tend to get more lift and a little less fact-checking. But I think that the thing that goes deeper is that, you know, audiences for right-wing media trust that media because it's right-wing. And they trust stories that confirm their political beliefs. And even if those stories end up being wrong, the attitude tends to be, well, okay, so maybe that story wasn't right, but the idea beneath it was right. And that is where it gets kind of complicated, that fake news, as it were, or these false stories and conspiracies, they have a much longer tail because the attitude is, well, you know, even if some of the facts are wrong, the underlying idea is right.
Yeah. So is there something, you know, I talked about the birther movement idea at the top of the show. We've talked about the death panel that emerged. What's happening now? Is there a version of this that is circulating as you watch and listen and read that you've noticed that people should be mindful of that is like not just an individual untruth, but something that is really circulating constantly. And I mean, there's the obvious example of the election.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the election is the one to pay attention to because it serves a much broader political agenda, right? It's not just about the 2020 election. It's not just about the insurrection on January 6th, but it is fueling all of these voter suppression laws in Republican-run states across the country. So when you have kind of a big lie that is attached to a political agenda, those are the spaces to really pay attention to because they get extra power because they're so politically useful. And I think that non-conservative media really need to be on guard for these things. You know, there was a story out today about a news station in Pennsylvania that is not platforming, is not letting people forget the mm-hmm. representatives who participated in trying to overthrow the election. And you know, it's something that we all have a responsibility to continue to call attention to, because not only does it have an effect on how people see the 2020 election, but whether we have free, open, fair elections going forward.
I saw reports that the Republican National Committee has been fundraising off of some of Tucker Carlson's more extreme outbursts also. I mean, have you tracked relationship between these sort of media moments and party fundraising at all? Is there a deliberate circle there?
Oh, there's very much a connection there. The Republican Party and conservative media are closely intertwined, and that was true prior to Donald Trump. But, you know, during the Trump years, Fox News in particular became just so closely interwoven with the Trump administration and with the Republican Party. You saw that with Sean Hannity having like nightly phone calls with the President Trump after his shows. There were a lot of behind the scenes conversations that were happening. And so, yes, I mean, there's a very close connection between the party and these media, which is not to say that Tucker Carlson, you know, calls up the chair of the RNC before he goes on to make sure that they have their fundraising letters ready. But the party knows that its base consumes this media, and so they target them accordingly.
Well, and vice versa, I would imagine. That's kind of what I'm getting at is, you know, does which card is who's driving here? You know, because I can, you know, how much is does Tucker Carlson know if I say this ridiculous thing tonight, it's going to have this effect because the RNC is going to amplify it?
Oh, I think that he is aware of how the things that he says are going to hit and how they intersect with the electoral prospects of the Republican Party. I do think that conservative media are more in the driver's seat than the Republican Party. Parties have tended to be quite a bit weaker in the last 20 or 30 years or so, which has really empowered conservative media. But there's almost always an eye on electoral prospects of the Republican Party in these conservative media outlets.
Let's go to Tammy in Bridgewater, New Jersey. Tammy, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a big Tucker Carlson watcher. I watched CNN exclusively for my adult life, and then I started to get very friendly with an African-American woman that I work with who is a conservative, and she turned me on to Tucker Carlson. And, you know, we have kind of water cooler talk every morning about what he talked about the night before, and she really kind of opened my eyes to the racism that she was feeling from the left about how you know, African-Americans don't know how to get ID and they don't know how to use computers. And she found that insulting. So then, you know, we talked about how the left has a narrative. So I also, we had a big conversation with that Project Veritas undercover video came out. And the producer admitted that they do propaganda reporting for their own personal narrative. And I just wondered what your take was on that.
You're talking about the Project Veritas videos. This is a conservative media outlet that media project defines itself as investigative reporting. And they have been behind a number of sort of big gotcha stories, getting people on the left in various positions. That you're talking about them admitting
the,
to
the latest
just to clarify.
One with the CNN. Yeah, the latest one with the CNN producer when he did talk about there was false reporting and things that they did to make sure that Donald Trump, you know, would not get elected, and then making Joe Biden look better, making sure they didn't bring up maybe some of his gaffes or, you know,
okay,
whatever,
so,
you know.
Thank you, Tammy. So, Nicole, I'm not sure the video that Tammy's talking about, but I am familiar with many of these Project Veritas videos that are repeatedly proven to be heavily edited and also full of misinformation and often lies. It sounds like there's one I don't know of. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but in general, can you sort of talk about the role that outlet plays if you're familiar with them?
Yeah, so Project Veritas, I mean, you're right that they're often heavily edited, but they create these, you know, these powerful visual films that spread like wildfire across conservative media. And that connection there with Tucker Carlson is interesting, right? Because it speaks to the way that conservative media work as an ecosystem. So a Project Veritas video doesn't just live off in the wilderness on its own, where you have to like track down James O'Keefe in order to get a copy of it, but it's played regularly on Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity and on talk radio. And it becomes kind of a network of authority because you hear so many people talking about the same video and you hear the repetition of it again and again, that it becomes a pretty potent and powerful political weapon, even in the case of some of O'Keefe's videos that have been proven not to be what he proposes they are.
We got to wrap up, but I wonder, you know, for somebody who has spent, you said since 2004, watching and studying conservative media, I would find that to be dispiriting about the state of our politics and the state of our political culture. How does it leave you? What's your takeaway from doing that work?
Well, I think that it's important work. I'm not going to say that it is always heartening, but I think it's so important to understand the role that media outlets play in shaping our politics and making sense of where they fit in our political culture and in shaping the outcomes of our elections and shaping the way people see the country and see the world. So I find it pretty edifying work on that front, because it makes me feel like I have a better sense of what's going on. And there's a power in that.
Nicole Himmer is a political historian and researcher at Columbia University and author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics. She also co-hosts the podcast Past Present, in which she and other historians discuss American politics and culture. Nicole, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to everybody who called. Sorry, as always, to those who we didn't get to. You can always email me at anxiety@wnyc.org. Coming up, it's one thing to point the finger today at how far-right media profits off of racism and misinformation, but they learned it somewhere. Most of our largest, most mainstream news outlets were built on peddling anti-Black ideas for generations, and very few of them have owned up to that fact. That's next. Everybody, so I want to ask your help with something. A huge part of what we're doing with this show is building a community of people who want to share the joy and the work of creating and living in a healthy, plural society. That's why we've started taking calls on the live show and soliciting your tweets and your voicemails here.
Hey, this is Michael from Raleigh, North Carolina.
This is Ida in Austin, Texas.
Hi, Kai. My name is Dorian from Queens, New York.
My wildest dreams and imaginations. It's going to be hard for me to get through this note to you guys without getting emotional.
It's all part of building a community. And you can do two things to help build our community. First off, just invite somebody to join you in it. Maybe even start listening together on Sunday evenings. But however you do it, invite other people in. Second, you can leave a review on whatever app you're using to listen right now. You can give us a rating there, that's nice, but also leave a comment. Why do you listen? Why should others join you in listening? Again, think of it as making an invitation. It's how community works. So thanks in advance for doing either or both of those things. And even if you can't do either of them, thanks for being part of our community. Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright, and I'm joined now by another historian. Channing Gerard Joseph is a professor at the University of Southern California Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism. He wrote a cover story in this week's Nation magazine titled American Journalism's Role in Promoting Racist Terror. And he joins us to talk about his research for that article. Channing, thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me, Kai.
So you have a personal relationship to this history. I mean, we all do as Black people, of course, but tell us what specifically prompted you to write this article.
What prompted me to write the article was a conversation, several conversations that that I had last year during the racial injustice protests over George Floyd. That's really what sparked me realizing the necessity for this piece. During that time, a lot of conversations I was having with my colleagues at USC were around what we can do to make our curriculum more anti-racist, more, you know, sort of sensitive to diversity and inclusion, and more inclusive of stories about Black people. And I kept saying, we need to talk more about history. And I kept getting these sort of blank stares from colleagues. And it made me realize that a lot of the history of journalism, particularly journalism's role in promoting racism, is something that even journalism scholars don't know about. And it felt like something that was really necessary for me to speak out about.
Well, you also, so you're a bit of a family genealogist, it sounds like. My uncle would love your approach to this. And you keep, as I understand it, you keep on your bookshelf a record you found in a newspaper of an 1843 auction of some of your ancestors. And I wonder what it was like to find that in a newspaper.
Absolutely. There are some, I grew up in Louisiana, mostly in a town called Slidell, which is near New Orleans. And my family's from Slidell and from New Orleans proper, back many, many generations. And I had some great grandparents who were still around. And when I was younger, I used to love sitting at their knee and hearing stories that they told. Some of the stories were not so great, but I was sort of captivated by them. And I wanted to learn more about my own family's role in American history, really. One of the inspirations during this research was a story that my grandmother told me about a lynching that had happened in the middle of town, in which a Black man was dragged through the center of town and until he was dead, and then nobody was charged for his killing. And that was a story that I learned had happened in 1914. So this was an event that had been passed down really from generation to generation until me, and I'm passing it on to your audience here. Mm-hmm. And it drove home for me the point that these are stories that linger on in our lives. The specific thing you're asking me about the finding my ancestor in the newspaper was part of, you know, just part of continuing that journey of learning more about my family tree. And my ancestors, some of them were enslaved, and there are records of them being sold, being advertised for sale in newspapers. And as a journalist, it puts me sort of on both sides of the fence. I am both a descendant of the enslaved people who were put on sale, as well as somebody whose profession it is to report the news and to put out that newspaper. So it seemed to me like I was one of the most appropriate voices to tell that story.
Right. So in your article, you focus on newspapers and you talk about these ads as an important part of what built some of the newspapers that came to dominate our media landscape. What role did these ads play in those business models?
You know, the ads played an important economic role. You know, in the 19th century, one of the greatest sources of income for newspapers in America were classified ads. In many cases, those classified ads were specifically for the sale of enslaved people or to advertise enslaved people who had run away from their masters. And that was a constant and lucrative source of income for many newspapers that exist to this day, from the Baltimore Sun to the New Orleans Times-Picayune to the New York Post. All of those are newspapers that that profited from the sale of human beings, and part of the reason they exist to this day is because of that profit that they earned at that time.
And then pushing forward into the 20th century, or maybe the late 19th century and the early 20th century, you know, I think one of the things that a lot of folks don't recognize is how, when we talk about lynching in that era, how popular mm-hmm. news stories about mm-hmm. lynching were, and that how, and you write about how important they became to the growth of newspapers in general. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. So everybody knows, if it bleeds, it leads, that old phrase. And that's the idea that that blood and gore, you know, helps to drive up ratings, helps to sell media of all kinds. And that was true back in the late 19th, early 20th century. After the end of slavery, without that constant source of, you know, of classified ads for enslaved people, newspapers had to pivot a bit to gain readers and to keep readers. One of the ways they did that is through really sensationalized, lurid accounts of lynchings that sometimes were run on the front page. In some cases, reporters were sent to the scene of lynchings before they occurred. And in one particular case in 1900, Associated Press reporters were sent to the scene of a lynching in Colorado, in which a 16-year-old intellectually disabled black boy was burned at the stake. And reporters set up camp before the lynching occurred. And as it occurred, they sent reports along the wires across the country, letting newspapers from San Francisco to Chicago to New York know exactly what was going on. And the stories about that lynching appeared nationwide. And the tone of it was not to question lynching. It was to, in many ways, promote and justify lynching. In most of the newspapers that reported that story and that picked up that story were, you know, some of them might say that the method itself, the fact that it was burning a boy at the stake, was a little bit excessive, they would say, but he probably deserved it. So the vast majority of papers assume the guilt of people who were victims of mob violence for many decades.
You note that it wasn't only print, that radio played a big role as well. We don't think about radio in that era, but what role did radio play in sort of popularizing lynchings or spreading racial terror?
Absolutely. So there are, it is believed by scholars that radio played a big role in helping to drive out the message about lynchings that were about to occur and getting people mobilized in towns. In many cases, it was, you would have the entire white population of a town gather together to be present at a lynching. There was no way really, that there's a more efficient way to do that than through the radio. On the downside, a lot of those radio reports, we don't have any recordings of. We have newspaper accounts of some of those events. But one of the reasons I focus on print in the piece in The Nation is because newspapers that profited from lynching and profited from slavery are still around to this day. It's harder to make the connection that TV and radio profited from lynching, but they certainly participated and certainly have promoted racism in other ways. And maybe perhaps that's for another piece to delve in.
Well, let's talk about the newspapers then today. I mean, you know, and thinking about what do we do with this history now? I mean, so, you know, I have to say, and you can check me on this, but it feels to me like we're in this sort of remarkable era of sort of mainstream corporate news outlets making real efforts to center Black people in our work, you know, artists and thinkers and activists and political leaders. They all show up in the Times now. And what do you think? I mean, how do you look at this moment in the context of the history you've been digging through?
I think you're right that there has been some progress, but the reality is, you know, I reached out to many papers for this piece and many media organizations, some of which own dozens of other outlets, and very few are willing to come to grips with this past. Only a handful were willing to, you know, issue an apology. And I think that, that reality sort of underscores the fact that, one, we don't know the history, but also, two, there's still a reluctance to really acknowledge in a full-throated way and to really grapple with the consequences, long-term consequences of race in a genuine way. Those reports and those ads have had a material effect on Black people's lives, had a material effect on Black communities for generations. Those reports and those ads created helped to shape the lives we live today as Black people, and in many cases have a lot to do with why there's the inequality that we're still facing.
Can we name some names? I mean, who has apologized? Which of the publications have apologized? And what would apology achieve? And what does it need to look like to achieve something in your mind?
You know, I'm careful. I want to say that I don't want it to be about who's apologized and who hasn't. I want it to be about sort of a reckoning. I want papers to investigate, acknowledge, show us what they've done in the past. I think that's more significant than simply an apology. But an apology is certainly better than nothing. Papers that have apologized, well, the Associated Press is not a paper, it's a wire service. The Associated Press sort of issued a statement of regret. I think I count that as half an apology. there are the Kansas City Star is a notable example of a paper that spent months assigned reporters to spend months digging through archives, interviewing local community members about some of the racism that the paper had promoted. You know, the paper promoted redlining, it promoted segregation, it didn't allow Black people's obituaries to be printed for many years. And they spent months documenting, researching and documenting those things. And that would be, I think, one of the best responses is to have every publication go back in time, look at what they did, come forth with not just an apology, but lay everything out on the table. Tell us what happened. I
apply some journalism to it.
Absolutely. And, and you know, Mike Fannin is the editor of the Kansas City Star. And he told me that his motivation for doing what he did was, you know, trying to regain trust of communities that have lost trust in journalism, right? Like, it is an acknowledged fact that journalism has lost the trust of many different groups of people. And in order to gain back that trust, one of the ways to gain back Black people's trust, in Fannin's words, is to acknowledge what the paper has done in the past and lay it out. And I agree with that. I think that one of the best ways to acknowledge the truth is not to pretend that it didn't happen.
Right, right. Channing Gerard Joseph is a narrative journalist and professor at the University of Southern California Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism. He wrote a cover story in this week's Nation magazine titled American Journalism's Role in Promoting Racist Terror. Thanks for coming on, Channing.
Thanks so much, Kai. It's been a pleasure.
United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Jared Paul mixed the podcast version. Kevin Bristow and Milton Ruiz were at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Carolyn Adams, Carl Boisrond, Emily Botine, Karen Frillman, and Christopher Wirth. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Berlin Williams is our executive producer, and I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright, or drop me an email at anxiety@wnyc.org. And as always, I hope you'll join us for the live version of the show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. You can stream it at wnyc.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Till then, take care of yourselves. Thanks for listening.